You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Our passage today is a very short excerpt from the book of Amos. Amos is one of 12 of what are called the minor prophets of Hebrew Scripture. Minor only because they're short, not because they're not significant. There's nothing insignificant about the prophetic word of Amos. As scholars have placed Amos' writing around 750 before the Common Era, it makes Amos the oldest prophetic book of the Bible. His major themes pretty much go back and forth between a call for social justice and a warning of divine judgment. In other words, get your act together as a people. Stop oppressing the downtrodden, or there's going to be hell to pay. Well, fire and locusts specifically, but you get the idea.
Our words of wisdom today are from Amos 5:14-15. Seek good and not evil, that you may live. And so the Lord, the God of hosts, will be with you, as you have said. Hate evil, love good, and establish justice in the gate.
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. Thanks be to God.
It's a privilege for me to introduce you this morning to a friend and teacher from whom I haven't begun to learn all that I need to learn. I met Ahmad Daniels through the Islamic Speakers Bureau of Arizona, and in that capacity, some of you might recognize him as someone who has spoken at the Fountains on a number of occasions. As a teenager in 1966, Ahmad volunteered for the Marines. However, as a black serviceman preparing to go to Vietnam, Ahmad experienced a kind of racism that he never faced growing up in Queens. He quickly became disillusioned with the whole situation and started to question why he should fight for a country that considered him to be a second-class citizen. The military then used an obscure law to sentence him to 10 years in prison, essentially for asking questions. While in prison, he wrote to the ACLU, who took his case and eventually managed to get the findings of the court-martial reversed, and Ahmad was given an honorable discharge. And despite all that, Ahmad is still proud of having been a Marine. You can read more about his story in his book, From Queens to Quantico, a United States Marine story, available at Changing Hands Bookstore and on Amazon. Ahmad now works as a transformation facilitator and life coach, and was the first person I thought of when I wanted to start processing what's going on right now. So here's my conversation with Ahmad Daniels.
Good morning, Ahmad.
Good morning, David.
So with all of the unrest that's going on following the George Floyd murder and all of the protests and things that are going on, a lot of my congregation is asking questions about what can they do? How can they help? Moving forward, what can we do as middle-class white people of privilege to be allies in something more than just word?
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm reminded of a quote by abolitionist Frederick Douglass, who said, "Talking doesn't solve all problems, but no problems can be solved unless there's first some talking." So right there, we understand the importance of communication and the role it can play in the ameliorating of any problem that exists at that time. And many of your congregation, I'm sure, they've gone to diversity workshops and cultural competence workshops and seminars and webinars now that we have COVID-19. A lot of these communications occur the way we're doing right now. But what I don't find taking place right now is a question that I've begun to ask many white people who have interviewed me, and I interviewed them at some of the protest rallies I've attended here, is what does it feel like being white? I asked that question, what does it feel like being white? And inevitably the response is, I don't know. I never thought about that.
Yeah, that's because I don't think about it. Yeah.
I see myself as a human. I see myself as American, a Lutheran, a Baptist, a Seventh-day Adventist, Mormon, whatever, but not white. So if we agree with what Frederick Douglass said, that not all problems can be solved unless there's some talking, the talking has to occur where people are communicating. They're not just being nice and not engaged in niceties. And in order for that communication to occur, I always invite white people to go to their corners, go to their bedroom, wherever they go, and write down what it means to be white. Now, what they will inevitably do, if they're honest with themselves, they'll begin to take a look at all the white privileges they have, that they don't have to worry about being pulled over by a police car and run the risk of not starting that car and driving off again because you have a bullet someplace in your body. They don't have to worry about when they go into the bank and they're asked for three or four different forms of ID because you're cashing a check of some significant value. Now, these are things black folks have to deal with every day. So I think in many cases, David, when we talk about race and white supremacy and white privilege, white people automatically shut down in many cases because they don't think about race. Why is everything race, they say? Your people seem to have a chip on their shoulder. I say, no, we have a boot around our neck. And that has been the case for centuries. We, even with Rodney King, the beating, we said in our communities, oh my goodness, we got it on camera. This is going to come back as a guilty. Well, it did not. And black folk just took to the streets, which is what any intelligent people would do. I know you're saying, what, Maud, are you condoning violence? No, I'm condoning people who are tired of being patient, who are tired of being nice, and people who have read their American history. Remember the Boston Tea Party? When the colonists dressed up as Indians and threw all that British tea into the water? You know, and now I was taught that that was the thing to do, that that was okay. So what is the difference between them protesting against their police, who were the British, who were the Redcoats, and our protesting against police, who are the army, who the police, state police, federal guards, and everything else. So that's what I'd recommend first. Take a look at what it means to be white, because until that is addressed, everything else is going to be academic. Maybe they read any, they saw the video by Jane Elliott unpacking the invisible knapsack, where she lists 30 to 35, she's a white woman, where she lists 30 to 35 benefits, privileges that white people have that they don't even have to think about. And what the benefits are, David, what the benefits are when white people begin to do that, one, the humility comes back, and two, perhaps for the first time in their life, they began to enter the realm of humanity. They began to be human beings for the first time. They began to understand injustice, and they become intolerant of it, just as people of color have become intolerant of it. And the people who are marching up and down the streets, not just in America, but around the world, they viewed America for as long as we have. And they know that there's a lot of wrong that has to be righted, that has to be made right.
Maybe you could respond to this. My experience of going to seminary was a transformational experience because that was the first time that I ever in my life, having grown up here in Phoenix, genuinely interacted with people of color. I had housemates who were people of color, and my colleagues in class were people of color. And I still remember having this conversation with a black colleague. I was feeling very defensive. And I was like, come on, I'm not a racist. And he just laughed and he said, oh, come on. He said, what if you heard an alcoholic who you know is an alcoholic say, I'm not an alcoholic anymore? You'd say, no, you will always be an alcoholic. It's just whether you're recovering or not. So don't lie to yourself. What do you say to that?
Well, that is true. There are many whites, and normally these workshops are led or facilitated by whites, which is good, because I think when black people facilitate some of these workshops, those whites who are not that advanced in their training and they're having taken a look at themselves, they dismiss what the black people are saying because they expect them. They expect that they're beating up on them, and that white fragility kicks in at that point. Whites who are doing the work will be in a constant state of recovery. And it's the same thing with racism in America. It's imbued in all the institutions, economics, education, entertainment, labor, law, politics, religion, sex, and war. Those are the nine areas of human contact. And when you imbue those contacts with racism, white supremacy, it doesn't matter who's in office. You could have black people at the head, but if they're following rules and regulations and policies that have been instituted by some white person who did not have the interests of people of color in mind, you get the same effect. So yes, it's important that whites realize this is not work that you could say, I finished it. I now have a master's or a PhD in this. It's ongoing. Until we get rid of some of the systemic institutions that have this racism, we're going to have this conversation each and every year, just as people began having it in the 1700s, 1800s, 1900s. Dr. King had it, Malcolm had it, Du Bois had it. We will continue to have it because the issues aren't going to be addressed. Now, and as Dr. King said, the arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice. What we're watching on TV right now are just a small portion, a small sign of the justice that must occur if we are to become human beings and not these angry, angry people that we are, misinformed, misled, and ignorant as we want to be.
And living in a bubble. Living in our own bubbles.
Yeah. Yes, and very happy to be there. And don't want anybody telling us that what we've done for centuries is now a suspect, and we have to go about and change it in some way.
Right. The White Fragility book makes a point of saying that it's not the people of color's responsibility to twist themselves into knots to avoid making white people feel comfortable. But that seems to be the expectation.
That is the expectation. And when white people come to conferences, it's amazing how one white person in a room can change the tenor of the conversation that people of color will have. We will be cognizant of their presence, and we won't want to say things unless I'm there. We won't want to say things that may hurt their feelings. So we'll tiptoe around certain things and we'll engage on all the niceties, which do white people a grave disservice, because they leave thinking, oh, everything must be okay. It must be those people over there who are the troublemakers. Because the people I was in a workshop with, they were fine. We need to get over the fact that feelings are going to get hurt. But I could give a blankety blank about hurt feelings when lives are being lost each and every day.
Yeah. Give me an example of something that you have to, or if you've experienced having to tiptoe around in order to maintain civility or the feelings of someone else.
Give you an example of dealing with talking about white privilege. It's hard for white people to realize that many of them were born on second base and they think they hit a double.
Yeah,
I mean, that is a difficult concept for them to get around, because I believe they're looking at it in a, they didn't apply for that. They didn't sign up for it. It's just something that they have. When I was at the rally in Chandler, and I have on, just like I have on, I'm going to show you this, my Marine Corps jersey. I'm a cyclist, and I wear my Marine Corps jersey because I seem to get a little more respect from the motorists coming up behind me. And every now and then I get a simple fine from somebody who's in the car. So this police officer, you know, he says, simple fine, brother. And even though he was white, if you are in the Marine Corps, you're my brother. Because we went through the same hell in boot camp. He went to Hollywood. I went to Paris Island. Yeah. My boot camp's a lot harder than his, but we won't quarrel about that. But later on, we had about a 30-minute conversation about, he said, well, you know, two wrongs don't make a right. So and he's saying that the police who killed our good brother, that was a wrong. And I said, no, it wasn't one wrong make a right. There were four of them there. Mm-hmm. Four of them made that wrong. And at that point, only one had been arrested. The other three were quite free. So those kind of conversations right there. But it was good having that conversation with him, because one, we didn't agree, but we were able to disagree without becoming so disagreeable. But I say that to say that there is a need sometimes for people to take to the streets. And when you do that, like Dr. King said, a riot is the voice of the unheard. These people want to be heard. But that was the tipping point. People said, we can't take it anymore. And I think white people respect that.
Yeah, I think back to MLK's letter from a Birmingham jail where he wrote to, you know, his white clergy colleagues and said, you know, I hear you saying you're upset with the demonstrations, and I'm sad that you're upset with the demonstrations, but haven't said a word about the conditions that existed that gave rise to the demonstrations. When are we going to hear that?
When are we going to hear that? And Dr. King also said that he finds it easier, perhaps, my words here, to get along with the Ku Klux Klan than those whites who go to church every Sunday, pay their bills on time, and profess to be non-racist. He said those are the ones, and those are the ones that wrote the letter about King, right, saying, what is he doing in town? He's a troublemaker.
Yeah, stay in your place.
Stay in your place. And I dare the audacity of the oppressor who has his hands around your neck to tell you how you should respond to his oppression of you.
Yeah.
He doesn't have that right. Yeah. He doesn't have that prerogative to be able to say that. The person whose neck is being strangled should respond by any means necessary.
Sounding like Malcolm X there now.
Well, that was his phrase that he coined. And that's, he's certainly my favorite leader. He's the one that woke me up.
I know.
And he also familiarized me with liberation theology.
Yeah.
For a long time, I didn't like King because I thought King was a pacifist and he wasn't doing anything to awaken the minds. But when the 65 Voting Rights Act was passed and he began to broaden his outlook and took a stand against the war in Vietnam, he began to attack those triple evils of racism, militarism, and economic exploitation. And that's when King was no longer invited to the White House by President Johnson.
Yep.
And he began to evolve. He started using the word black. But liberation theology, the church must address the church, mosque, synagogue, faith institution, must address the social needs of the people. And if they fall short of that, what good is the faith institution if they can't do that, the social needs?
What can you share with the congregation that you think they need to hear right now about their opportunity to spend their privilege making a change?
Allies must be willing to sacrifice something. If it's nothing more than, some people know that they're not going to get involved, they're not going to walk in the street, so they'll write a check. They'll take out their checkbook and they'll fund certain causes, which is good. But to be side by side like those people were in the civil rights, and we remember Schwerner and Goodman, those two Jews who were in Philadelphia, Mississippi, along with Cheney, who were killed.
Yep.
And we remember some of the other ministers who were killed also by whites. That's a different kind of commitment there. And we're not asking anybody to make that kind of commitment. But you have to study. You have to be in a continuous, evolving sense of who I am as a white person and what baggage I carry with me. Otherwise, you come off as artificial. You come off as disingenuous. You come off as some benevolent white father who wants to come down from the heavens and come down to the hood and do some good and then go back and feel better about oneself. That doesn't work. You have to see your very humanity tied into what you're doing, not your whiteness. You want to be able to transcend that at some point, but to make you a better human being, to be a follower of Christ. To be a follower of Christ means carrying the cross. And some of us don't remember that Good Friday comes before Easter. Before the crown you wear, there's the cross to bear. So you got to bear that cross. And that may mean taking a back seat. It may mean being not trusted, because doggone well, black people got reason not to trust white people. It may mean doing away with your fragility, being able to brush it off, being able to let water, like a water rolls down the back of a duck, let that happen. And yet, when all that happens, you dust yourself off and get right back in the race. Because that's what we've had to do with white America. We've gone to every war this country's ever had, fought the best that we could possibly could, equal, if not surpassing, whites with the training they gave us and the weaponry. And we come back hoping to be able to sit in the front of the bus or be able to treat it like first-class citizens. And we're lynched from trees while still wearing this country's uniform. So if we were able to bounce back, if we haven't lost faith in this country, I dare you have the audacity to think that because someone calls you a name, you come back with hurt feelings, and therefore you dismiss it and say, well, I tried. No, you got to keep coming back. You got to have Job's perseverance, yeah. Right? God told him, the devil told God, if you remove that protective hedge, I think Job will curse you. And God said, well, do what you want, just don't kill him. And Job stayed the way. He stayed the course. You got to have that Job mentality. Wow. That's what I'd recommend. Keep coming back. Keep coming. Yeah. Keep reading. Keep coming back. And the goodness, the genuineness will show after a while. But don't expect it to happen overnight. It ain't that kind of party.
And that's, I think, one of the messages that I'm hoping that this current situation is going to be, as you say, a tipping point, that it's going to be something that lasts longer than other situations like this have lasted.
Well, that's up to us. That's up to me, and it's up to you, and it's up to the people in the streets. And I'm so glad to see white people in the streets, because I believe these are white people who have been gassed to some rate, and they've been touched. They've been touched. Their heart has been touched. And we're creating now a generation of white people who abhor white supremacy, who will not give in to white privilege, white people who have the opportunity to be human beings side by side with black and brown and gay and everybody else who's out there too. That's what America is supposed to be about. Not a melting pot, but a salad bowl where each ingredient yep. contributes to the overall savory of the meal.
Ahmad, I so appreciate you taking time to share with us today. Is there something that I haven't asked that you feel like you want to share that we need to hear?
No, but I would like to end with a quote by Langston Hughes, the great poet and playwright. He said, hold fast to dreams, for if dreams die, life is like a broken winged bird that cannot fly. We have to dream of a better time. We have to read our respective faith books and know that this isn't something that was written, well, they may have been written thousands of years ago, but these are ideals that apply to us if only we up our expectations and begin to implement what these things said and expect to be uncomfortable. If we're not uncomfortable, we're not doing something right. If we're not being challenged by other people, we're attempting to please the crowd. And that's what happened to Jesus and Barabbas. He had a choice to free Jesus, but the crowd said, we want Barabbas. So Jesus was crucified and Barabbas went on his way. Let's do the right thing for the first time in history.
Thank you, Ahmad. So grateful for you and for your being with us this morning.
Thank you for the work you're doing, David. And hello to your congregation.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.